le Hollandais, salut à toi le Portugais, salut à toi le Mexicain, salut à toi le Marocain, salut à toi le Libanais, salut à toi le Pakistanais, salut à toi le Philippin, salut à toi.
On WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Reese Helmick with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, July 22nd. The Meadows Country Club filed for bankruptcy, shutting down its three golf courses, tennis courts, and other facilities, the Herald Tribune first reported. Meadows residents are confused due to the recent purchase of club land by the Community Association, a body governed by a 9-member board of directors. The Meadows is one of the area's first golf communities, expanding to three courses totaling 54 holes, 85 lakes and waterways, and 14 miles of walking and biking trails. The club was challenged by damage from last year's hurricanes. Even though it has undergone multiple renovations, including a $1.5 million refresh, members claim the 18-hole course is still in disarray. Talk of selling the club began in 2018. That same year, the Community Association purchased more than 310 acres from the country club for $6 million to keep the acreage as green space and prevent development. The association then leased the land back to the country club for $10 per year, but in March, the club terminated the lease. The association is now considering leasing the land to a third-party golf club operator. Local governments have accomplished much to address the shortage of affordable housing, but much more has to be done, according to executive of the Florida Housing Coalition. Cody Glazer was a guest speaker at a Greater Sarasota Area Chamber of Commerce event. He said that due to mass migration during the pandemic, 15,000 affordable homes must be added in the next 10 years. Glazer brought with him a blueprint developed by the Florida Housing Coalition that suggests active participation across public, private, and philanthropic sectors. Glazer said that once every 3 years, local governments have to look at the land they own and identify land that is appropriate for affordable housing. U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins met with Florida agriculture leaders Monday to give them the good news that her agency has signed a grant for $675 million to provide recovery assistance for Florida farmers following the last 2 years' hurricanes. The funding will be available to farmers in counties designated as disaster areas or contiguous in 2023 and 2024 to help with infrastructure damage, market loss compensation, and citrus-specific damage. Florida farmers have suffered more than $3 billion in losses from hurricanes Idalia, Debbie, Helene, and Milton. A University of Florida report estimates that agriculture losses from the 2024 hurricane season reached nearly $970 million. This has been Reese Helmick with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, July 22nd.
You're listening to WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
This is show 66 of our changing environment. The previous show was Corduroy, hosted by Sebastian.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm John O'Miller, and the show is being recorded and broadcast on July 22nd, 2025.
Today we're going to be doing something different, chatting for a half hour with former county commissioner and current Florida Gulf Coast Trail Director for the Trust for Public Lands, and then we'll be reviewing six books that have been very meaningful for us and which deal with changing environments.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Our guest today is Charles Hines, and it's great to have you here in the studio. And I think most people recognize you as a former county commissioner, and we'll get to your current work, but what else should our listeners know about you?
Well, good morning. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all and your audience here in Sarasota County and hopefully beyond. To answer your question, lifelong resident. Born in Venice, went to Venice High School. Parents moved here in the mid-50s. Jono, you'll like this. I think you know this story. Yeah. My mom and dad bought a 5-acre parcel right on the Myakka River when it was nothing but dirt roads and rattlesnakes and alligators. So I know that river is so important to you all, and it's been important to me. So I went to University of Florida, went to undergrad and law school there, and came back in 1990. and practiced law for a number of years, and I've always been involved in the community. And that's really what drove me to the county commission, is trying to, you know, make our community better, be involved, be a servant. And so I really appreciate the opportunity that our donors at TPL have done to allow the creation of this Florida Gulf Coast Trail program and the initiative that we're working on to complete this trail from Tampa to Naples, 420 miles. It's a big deal.
So let's start with TPL itself. What is the Trust for Public Land, and what are some of the different things it undertakes?
Great, thanks. And Trust for Public Land is a national nonprofit. It's been around since 1950, and it spun out of the Nature Conservancy because of a little difference of opinion versus land versus people. And the thing about Trust for Public Land is our, you know, motto is connect people to the outdoors. And so we work with local and state and federal government to create trails and parks, but with a focus of people. How do people, you know, get to these places? What's the use going to be? Is it going to be a playground, a trail? So it's different than buying, let's say, environmentally sensitive lands and then just locking it off. So that's kind of our focus. We work a lot with different land trusts, and we try to balance is, okay, here's an opportunity to create something. Is it better to be land that just needs to be protected and left alone? Or is it an opportunity to put land in public ownership, but then allow people to use it? And so that's what the Trust for Public Land does. We've been in Florida for 50 years. We've done probably close to 450 projects across the state. And this Florida Gulf Coast Trail is just probably one of the biggest initiatives, because it involves seven counties, probably 30 cities at least, the state and federal government, local nonprofits. So it's a huge tent to try to get everybody, you know, aligned to fund and build the trail. But that it's a fun task.
So you mentioned a 420-mile trail on the west coast of Florida. Of those 420 miles, how many are in place right now?
About half.
Half.
Yeah, and so that sounds good. The issue is there's gaps.
Yeah.
It's not like the state of Florida said, okay, we're going to build this 420-mile trail, start in Tampa and go south and keep building.
Right. It's not like they're 210 miles of continuous trail.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so that's where we come in, and we try to identify where there's a gap, where there's local government that says we're ready for this. And the extension of the Legacy Trail from a couple years ago from Palmer Ranch to downtown, it was clear that Sarasota County residents said, we really, really want this. And so Trust for Public Land worked with Sarasota County, acquired the rail corridor, worked like with you all on the ballot measure to buy it and fund it. And I'm not saying that was a no-brainer, because it took a lot of work, but that's what we look for all the time. Where is there a gap where there's a city, a county, that will ultimately own the dirt and maintain the trail? Sometimes it's a state. And let's go after that one. Let's fill in another gap. Take an 18-mile one and make it 32 miles. And then take that 32-mile one and connect it up with another 18-mile one by filling in a 4-mile gap. Suddenly now you have a 60-mile loop. Now you have something.
So are we talking about bicycling and hiking? What are the recreational uses of the trail?
Good question. So the term that everyone likes to use now is called a MRT, multi-use recreational trail.
Okay.
So the criteria that we try to shoot for in the Florida Gulf Coast Trail is separated, mm-hmm. meaning not a bike lane, mm-hmm. 12 feet wide, multi-use, bicycles, walking, rollerblades, you know, those types of uses. And so some people might use it for long distance bike riding. Others may use it 2 miles, like we were talking earlier, to get to a grocery store, get to work, get to school. But so that's where the term multi-use recreational, and it's not always recreational, I'll just say multi-use trail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when people first started dreaming about converting the rail line here in Sarasota to a recreational trail, we hadn't really encountered these motorized bicycles that we have now. So What's the thinking and what's appropriate and what's inappropriate?
Well, I would say that's still evolving in people's minds. Right. When I was on the county commission, we had a rule that electric bikes were not allowed on the trail. And then people were asking us to change that rule. And so my mind came around of, wait a minute, I'm almost denying greater use of this trail for folks who maybe either, you know, usually physical disabilities that can't use it. So let's say my spouse is fine. You know, she can ride, you know, 30 miles, but I can't. I got a bad knee.
Okay.
So I can't get out there. Now with an electric bike, I can get out there and I can do things. Same thing with getting to work. If you can get there a little quicker, a little easier.
Less sweaty.
Less sweaty, exactly. We want to encourage that. So it's not, I think we're past the idea of, oh, well, electric bikes are cheating.
Uh-huh.
No, it allows more people to use it. It's an enforcement and an education thing because of speed.
Yeah.
But there's guys on bikes that can go pretty fast too.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's, you know, that's the, our trail is getting so much use now. When I say our trail, I'll say the Legacy Trail segment. We could potentially reach 1 million users this year.
Wow.
So it's education. The Friends of the Legacy Trail do a great job out there every weekend at different trailheads trying to let people know, use the trail respectfully. And so that's kind of where we are now. And we had a grand opening yesterday, ribbon cutting for the overpasses at Clark and Bee Ridge. And one thing that was there and it was nice to see was there's representatives there from the Sheriff's Department.
Oh, good.
And so, you know, they've bought in that, yes, they have a role in this linear park, this trail. And so it was nice to see their representatives there.
So tell us what gaps need to be filled, especially in Sarasota and Manatee counties.
Yeah, so focus on Sarasota for a second. What's underway right now? So the gap that exists from the Legacy Trail now to Nathan Benderson Park.
Uh-huh.
So that one is underway, and that's going to be a partnership of the Friends of the Legacy Trail, Gulf Coast Community Foundation, Trust for Public Lands, City of Sarasota, Sarasota County, MPO. It's a lot of people involved, but that's about 3.5 miles. So you can go from Beneva Road, where it crosses now, out to Nathan Benderson Park. And go through Bobby Jones Golf Course, go through 17th Street Park, and then get out to a county-owned Nathan Benderson Park. And we all know what's going on out there. So that is going to connect so many people, so many businesses, to create a sense of place that if I come in from wherever for a rowing event, I can rent a bike and ride to downtown Sarasota or downtown Venice. So that gap will be filled here in the next few years. So it's in the works, but until it's done, you still get nervous.
Yeah.
So what I'd say to your listeners is when you see your elected officials in the city and the county, tell them thank you. Please accelerate this. Get it done as quick as you can, and because that will connect so many people. We're also working on an extension to Warm Mineral Springs down in Northport. It's a simple project. It's about 1.5 miles long. All the land's publicly owned. But it's a partnership with the city of Northport and Sarasota County to get that done. And then Warm Mineral Springs, the great natural amenity or feature that it is, will now become a major bicycle trailhead to go through great, beautiful, open space, Deer Prairie Creek, and that protected land. So Northport, Warm Mineral Springs, Nathan Benderson Park, and then we need to work on an east-west connection from the Legacy Trail over and down to River Road. River Road's under construction right now. The trail will be there. So then we need to go to South River Road. So we keep going. But Sarasota's really close. It's not vision anymore. It's reality. Manatee County's tough. They got great plans. They have great maps. They have great people. They have very few trails. And we got to get going on that. They have some money. Congressman Vern Buchanan got them a lot of money a couple years ago, I think over $3 million to do some planning and design. But we got to do those connections. Rex Jensen at Lakewood Ranch has done a good job privately building trails. So Manatee County is something we really, really got to work on to be able to fill in a lot of gaps through there.
So the there's the 420-mile trail, but is the spur that goes over to Benderson, is that considered part of it, or is that ancillary? How do you view that?
So we have the Legacy Trail.
Right.
So the Legacy Trail and the term of that is actually a linear park in Sarasota County, and I'm getting real technical here, but there is some protections to the name because as it is a park, Parks and Rec look at it as a park, not just a trail. So we hear the term Legacy Trail Connector. I'm going to reverse it and say this is all part of the Florida Gulf Coast Trail. Within the Florida Gulf Coast Trail, you can have local segments that are named after something like a Legacy Trail. Or in the Pinellas Trail, you have the Duke Energy Trail. So Duke Energy paid some money, put their name up there. Uh-huh. There's others that are named after important people for a segment for, you know, respect for the work that they've done. So you can have segments that will be named, but the whole goal is to get the whole region to recognize the overall Florida Gulf Coast Trail.
Yeah, there's the main line that goes from Pinellas to Naples. And then there's what I'm calling spurs. If you go to Benderson, you're going to have to turn around and come back. But if you're on, but when the trail's completed, you'd have to go to Naples before you would have to turn around and come back.
That's right. That'd be nice.
Yeah.
But so it's kind of, you know, look at the Florida Gulf Coast Trail as I say your spine, and that's the main trail.
Got it.
But we have tons of nerves and veins and whatever that will connect to it that are either be widened sidewalks or even just sidewalks or other bike lanes, which we can get into that, but don't like bike lanes. But that's okay.
Okay.
But we need to, for my reason, is to stay focused on getting the main trail done, getting that, and then the opportunity trails is what they call them.
Got it.
Come.
Yeah. So go ahead, Julie.
So, are there ideas about how to encourage bike rental places along the trail?
Sure. I mean, you know, really just capitalism will come. I mean, when you see there's an opportunity, there's already a bicycle place out in Nathan Benderson Park and it's not even there yet. When you see the opportunity to do this and the biking community is a very tight-knit group. They talk a lot. They do all the bike rallies and different things. They see where it's going, and I think there'll be a ton of private investment. Now, whether it's public-private in that you're using public property to rent space to do a bike rental place. John and I were talking earlier we have all these public parks and public spaces. You know, where do people stop? You want to have a destination. So when you design the trail, you look for connectivity where people can go to a restaurant, go to an ice cream shop, connect to a school, those types of things. So that's fun. I think the private sector will step in because it'll be a great opportunity for some economic benefits.
So what are the minimum standards in terms of what the trail has to – how it has to perform?
So what most people hear – the state of Florida created the Sun Trail program about 10 years ago. And when you title a car, there's some money that's set aside for alternative transportation. And so the Sun Trail program, which is really what most people hear when you talk about these state trails, so it's state money. So the standards, pretty simple. It's separated from the road. It's paved and 12 feet wide.
Okay.
That's it.
All right.
And if you can't get 12 feet because it's just not feasible because there's a building there or there's something, a lake, you can go a little smaller, but you want that to be the exception. So, and then like even in Sarasota County, Legacy Trail is 12 feet wide. And now that we're adding a separate lane in places where there's enough right of way to do that, because you can have like a through rider that's going pretty quick, and then you have somebody pushing a baby stroller or walking a dog. And if you have the opportunity to separate those, it's a lot safer.
So let's get into the weeds again. People are trained to walk their dog on their left, and the dog wants to be on the grassy side. And so if you have a conventional trail system, you're putting the dogs in the center of the trail when they want to be. So how does that all get unraveled?
I hear what you're saying. And that's the example is, I think, if you give a bifurcated trail.
Okay.
Or we got to retrain dogs. I can't fix that one. But, yeah, I would hope the dog would walk on the right side in the grass.
Yeah.
It makes things easier if you have to do cleanup.
Yeah.
So is there a trail that a bicycle trail that goes from the Gulf Coast to the Atlantic Coast?
Yeah, so it's called the Coast to Coast Trail, and it's there. It's ready to go. People will say it's 99% done. There's just one gap that you have to get into a bike lane. You can't do that. So that was the number one trail priority for the state for the last decade. And the way the state works, and this is the Office of Greenways and Trails, under the Department of Environmental Protection, that's the trail that they worked on. They focused on that to get that done. And so the Gulf Coast Trail was the third trail in their priority. So it didn't get a lot of attention. No, just this way the state works. We're going to put all of our money that we can on this number one trail. The other one that they're working on right now is the Sea Loop Trail up by Jacksonville. And that was a pretty small trail. Then we're next. But so we kind of talking about filling in gaps. Trust for Public Lands saw this gap and said, if we wait 5 or 10 years, there's going to be so much development, so many missed opportunities to put a trail in where there's still opportunity. And what I mean by that is dropping a trail into a developed urbanized area is very difficult. Okay. You don't have that many rail corridors to purchase. If you do, that's great. But once a building's there, once a road is built, if you miss the opportunity to put the trail in, it's really hard to come in later. So opportunity obtained, River Road. River Road, we got in there. It's under construction. You got the trail on both sides of River Road. Opportunity missed is you saw how hard it was to get a complete street project on Ringling in the city of Sarasota. I'm not saying it was missed, but how do you do that? You have to take away two lanes of a road. Pretty controversial. Now, I think that's probably been there 2 years, and I don't hear anybody complaining about it, but that was hard to do. So we need to stay out in the forefront. We all know the development that's occurring east of I-75, and especially in South County. How do we work with those developers so that we can get some trail alignment? How do we work with FDOT so they're aware that we can put this trail here so that when the people move into the homes, the trail's there? So that's been one of the hardest things, and that's why we didn't want to wait.
So where does the Coast to Coast Trail start and end?
It ends in Titusville. You go north of the Pinellas Trail, and it hooks up in just out of Pasco County, and goes right across the strait, across the state, north of Orlando. Mm-hmm. I'm not describing it very well, but just Google Coast to Coast Trail, and it has some good maps. It's about a 2-day ride, and there's, you know, Florida Rambler, I think, is an organization that puts together group rides, gives you the van and transportation and place to stay. So those are nice, you know, long weekend trips for folks.
So I know you've emphasized the multi-use, that some people might use it to get to school or grocery stores. Some people are commuting to work. But what do we know about bicycle tourism in the state of Florida? How big is that?
I can't quote the number, but it is greatly increasing. I think what you do, the best example that we have locally is Dunedin. If you go up just north of St. Pete and you look at the Pinellas Trail that's been there now about 20, 25 years, it has really created a sense of place because of the trail. Winter Garden in the middle of the state's another good one that people travel to ride those trails. Now, the coast-to-coast one you just mentioned now is one that Visit Florida can package together a deal and say, come to Florida, you know, fly into Tampa, put a package together and do that. We haven't really had that. The Keys, the overseas highways, you know, Keys had one for that does pretty well, but it's not a complete one. So we're still evolving.
Yeah.
But we're getting better. And I like to be able to point to an example where someone says, this really doesn't make a difference. And then you go up to a Dunedin and go, that completely changed this whole community.
Yeah. One of the stories I remember hearing when the Pinellas Trail went in is that the neighbors all had fences and thought people were going to come in and steal their TVs. And then before long, the fences had gates in them and people were trying to figure out how to get out on the trail.
So that's what, thanks for bringing that up. Yeah. Because part of doing shows like this is to help educate people that that's just not true. There's criminal studies, there's economic studies all across the country that say property values go up. Crime usually goes down. If not, it stays the same. And you have opportunity to have access to this great trail. I still have to deal with that every time I come to a new segment. But I always point to something like a Palmer Ranch, where you look at now all the high-end homes that have gates that, you know, allow people to get out to it. They advertise in all real estate sales, easy access to the Legacy Trail. So you're not advertising something that's
right.
A negative.
That's right.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's one down in Venice on 681 that's being built right now that they named the development Villages on the Trail. So, and they got a great gate that puts them right out there. And so it takes a lot of community workshops, time to talk to the community, to explain to them, I'm not just speaking in theory. Here's ones that you can look at. And this will be a great amenity for your community. So that's a lot of the work that I do is working with communities to get them to go, I want this for us.
Yeah, it's a real amenity.
So is there anything else that you'd like to say about the Southwest Florida Trail?
Well,
Gulf Coast.
Gulf Coast. So what I would, you know, I would ask people, we're so lucky here in Sarasota because everybody knows about the Legacy Trail. And a lot of people have used it and really enjoy it. So what I would ask your listeners is, if that's the case, as I said earlier, when you talk to elected officials, whether it's the state, you know, city, county, those are probably the big three. Federal comes in when it's a big, big project like the overpass on I-75 that's coming in there at Nathan Benderson Park. Tell them thanks for their support, but continue to support it because, you know, we were talking about local government funding earlier off air is they got to prioritize things. And the only way they know what to prioritize is what their constituents tell them. And, you know, trails, they're not red or blue. They're green. And they touch everything, whether it's, we talked about capitalism, we talk about economic development, we talk about safety and access to school, access to parks, stormwater things can be worked out when you get a big trail like the Legacy Trail. It hits all of them. So that's what I would ask is keep promoting them, keep telling your elected officials that you want more trails.
Well, Charles, you probably wake up every morning thankful that it wasn't named the Gulf of Mexico Trail.
That's funny.
So, Charles, this show will be in the archives, and our listeners can direct their friends to go back in the WSLR archives and listen to this show, and you'll be able to provide a link, and if people are curious about some of this content, they can listen to it.
And is please just go to Trust Republic Lands website, or you can just Google Florida Gulf Coast Trail and it comes up. Take a look at our maps. And what I would offer is if you have a group, a community, an HOA where we can look at maps and I can hopefully garner your support for my work for Trust Republic Land and the Florida Gulf Coast Trail, happy to meet with you.
Yeah, and so that would be trustforpubliclands.org, and then you can just look for the Florida Gulf Coast Trail.
To me, it sounds – this the easiest way is just Google Florida Gulf Coast Trail.
Yeah.
And it shoots you right to it.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah,
well,
great.
Thanks again for joining us. This is a great show, and great to have you here in the studio.
Thanks so much.
All right.
You are listening to WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
So we're going to switch it up now, right, Joe?
Yeah. Sarasota County government will host National Hire a Veteran Day Fair to connect veterans with career opportunities in public service. The event will take place on Thursday, July 24th at 1660 Ringling Boulevard in Sarasota. From 10 until 11 a.m., recruiting will be open only to veterans. From 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., recruiting will be open to the public. Veterans are encouraged to bring their resumes and be prepared for on-site, in-person interviews. More information is available at scgov.net/jobs.
So what we're going to do now is something we haven't tried before, and Julie and I are going to talk about some of the books that have really motivated us, we've found very rewarding. We're not telling you to buy the books. We're just letting you know they're interesting books. And are you willing to start, Julie?
Yeah. One of the books I chose is Beak of the Finch by Jonathan Weiner, and it was published in 1995, and it won a Pulitzer Prize. And this is based on Charles Darwin's historic visit to the Galapagos. And Peter and Rosemary Grant, who are professors at Princeton, have studied and measured finches on Daphne Major in the Galapagos Islands for two decades, or 20 generations. At this point, Daphne Minor has received only 5 millimeters of rain for the last 44 months. And variability in finch beak depth on Daphne Major deviates very slightly depending on whether there's heavy rainfall and whether there's been drought. And so this is like evolution happening in real time. And so when there's drought, the birds the finches that survive are the depth of their beaks becomes larger. And that's because they have to find and crack larger seeds that are during drought times. And then when there's a lot of lush and seed production, when there's been more rainfall, their bills decline in depth because the seeds are easier to harvest and easier to gain. And persistent through the book are references to Charles Darwin's Origin of Species, and there's excerpts from Darwin's writings that feature prominently. His work on barnacles and pigeons is also repeated in this book. Included are more recent examples of rapid evolution. Cotton farmers in Alabama douse their crops with DDT and then pyrethroids to kill budworms in cotton. And the caterpillar budworms kept developing resistance to these pesticides. The farmers likely do not believe in evolution, but their application of pesticides results in resistance and evolution for these budworm caterpillars.
Got it.
And then there's guppies who who occupied different streams separated by waterfalls, and there are seven fish that prey on the guppies, and higher in the stream there's only one predator, and as the guppies move downstream the number of predators multiplies. So the upstream guppies are gaudy with bright colorful spots, and the downstream guppies are paler and less gouty. Go ahead.
So the first book I want to talk about is called Reading the Landscape of America. It was written by May Thielgard Watts, and this was published in 1957, and it's got 21 chapters. Watts was a Midwesterner. She was a naturalist, an author. She was the first naturalist at the Morton Arboretum, which is, I think, west of Chicago. She studied under a guy named Henry Chandler Cowles, who really developed the theory of ecological succession. And she, because of Charles, I thought this was interesting. She was one of the founders of the Rails to Trails movement. And so she wrote this book with these 21 chapters, and they each one tells a story about change, and some are transects. And the one I wanted to start with is called Botanizing from a Lower Berth. And this is about a train. The subtitle is Winter Night Silhouettes, Chicago to Denver, January 1954. So she took a train at night and then made little sketches of what she saw outside the train windows and interpreted them. So I'm just going to sort of start in the middle. We were in a cut between hills, and the twigs were higher above our heads and made tighter, tangled, twisting mass against the sky. It was plain that these were the gestures of slow-growing hardwoods, the oaks, hickories and sugar maples. The sudden change in twigs came at a point where we left the bottom of the Lake Chicago of glacial times, the flatland where the city of Chicago is and the men who do her hog butchering live. Now, when we passed openings in the upland woods, it was plain that we were in the moraines that encircle the city, out in the higher suburbs, where live the men who will package and sell the butchered hogs, have white colors and briefcases and twin beds and coffee tables. Here were wider two chimney houses that drew apart from one another. Outdoor Christmas lights were dazzling here, but the indoor lights were dimmed, this no doubt because of Venetian blinds. So she's very observant. She's picking up on the trees, but also the Christmas decorations. And the last two sentences in this chapter are, in the railroad station in Denver, the train passengers soon mingled with the waiting crowds, but the people from Chicago were still easy to identify. They were the ones who wore galoshes. Back to you, Joel.
The next book I want to advocate for is The Swamp by Michael Grunewald, and it was published in 2006. Part one describes the natural Everglades. The Seminoles called it Paheoki, grassy water. It was 100 miles long and 60 miles wide. Water spilled out of Lake Okeechobee and moved slowly through sawgrass, which is a sedge, not a grass, and among tree islands to the mangrove coast of Florida Bay. Michael summarizes the efforts to remove the Seminoles in the 1800s. In 1845, after Florida became a state, there was an initiative to drain the Everglades. In 1855, the legislature passed a law to stimulate railroad construction by offering incentives of land and $10,000 for each mile of railroad construction. Hamilton Diston is profiled in the swamp, and he made a deal with Governor Bloxam to drain 12 million acres of Everglades wetlands and receive half of the swamp and overflow lands his dredges reclaimed. Diston only reclaimed 80,000 acres. Next, Grunewald describes how Henry Flagger pushed his railroad south from Jacksonville to Daytona Beach to West Palm Beach and on to Miami. He focuses on the plume hunters next and the fashion craze of women's hats in New York with wings and parts of Florida birds on their hats. We talked about that our last session on our changing environment. More recently, he focuses on the comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, SERP, and all of the political forces that eventually led to it being implemented. Jono and I have firsthand contact with many of the people associated with SERP, including Art Marshall, Governor Graham, Senator Graham, Nathaniel Reed, Joe Browder, and Marjorie Stoneman Douglas.
Okay, great. And someday we'll talk about how my ancestor helped sell the Everglades to Hamilton Diston.
Yeah.
So my next book is called Outside Lies Magic, and it's by John R. Stilgoe. It was written in 1998. This is a new one for me. Its subtitle is Regaining History and Awareness in Everyday Places. And Stilgoe's a professor of landscape history at Harvard. And I'm just going to start with the beginning of chapter one. He writes, get outside, or get out now, just not just outside, but beyond the trap of programmed electronic age, so gently closing around so many people at the end of our century. Go outside, move deliberately, then relax, slow down, look around, do not jog, do not run. Forget about blood pressure and arthritis, cardiovascular rejuvenation, and weight reduction. Instead, pay attention to everything that abuts the rural road, the city street, the suburban boulevard. Walk, stroll, saunter, ride a bike, and coast along a lot. Explore. Abandon even momentarily the sleek modern technology that consumes so much time and money now, and seek out the resting place of a technology almost forgotten. Go outside and walk a bit, long enough to forget programming, long enough to take in and record new surroundings. Let's see. My students often stare at me in amazement. They ask what kind of former students I have. Are they reliable or slightly odd? One just noticed escape hatches in the floors of inner city buses and inquired about their relation to escape hatches in the roofs of new school buses. Another has reported a clutch of Virginia, Kentucky barns in an Idaho valley and wonders if the structures suggest a migration pattern. A third has found New York City limestone facades eroding and trying to see if limestone erodes faster on the shady side of streets. A fourth has noticed that playground equipment has changed rapidly in the past decade and wonders if children miss galvanized steel jungle gyms. Another has been trying to learn why some restaurants attract men and women in certain professions and repel others. And another found a pattern in coffee shop location. Yet another reports that he can separate eastbound and westbound passengers at O'Hare Airport by the colors of their raincoats. So this is exactly like the galoshes that May Theodgard Watts is reporting. He writes, this is a straightforward guidebook to exploring, but not a comprehensive study of the things mentioned in it. It suggests that a little acute observation of ordinary things like power lines, railroad rights of way, post office equipment, back roads and shopping districts, alleys and the interstate highway system, fences and revitalized main streets, even motels and highway interchanges open up larger issues that invigorate the mind and entice understanding. And I'll just read one other passage from later in the book. Square fields require less fencing than rectangular ones, for example, but explorers quickly discover that farmers prefer rectangular fields. A square field, 400 feet on a side, contains 160,000 square feet and needs 1,600 feet of fence. A rectangular field, 200 by 800, includes the same area but must have 2,000 feet of fencing. Why, then, would a farmer choose to lay out rectangular fields? The explorer finds the answer in watching a farmer operate a tractor across a field or a homeowner run a lawnmower across a lawn. The square field demands more turnarounds than the rectangular field, and turning around wastes time and effort.
So the third book I'm going to profile is Killing Mr. Watson by Peter Matheson, published in 1990. Peter's historical novel deals with Ed Watson and his relations with other rough-living residents of the 10,000 Islands. The prologue begins with Killing Mr. Watson after a hurricane, October 24th, 1910. A number of men on Chokoloskee hear Mr. Watson approaching on his motor launch and aim to greet him with rifles and kill him. Matheson uses multiple voices to depict the events. One voice is Henry Thompson, and another voice is Richard Hamilton, and another voice is Bill House, and then another voice is Carrie Watson, Ed Watson's daughter, who called her father Mr. Watson. Harry Thompson reports that Ed Watson was the only planter south of Chokoloskee that ever made a living on Chatham River. He made his living growing sugarcane and making cane syrup. Richard Hamilton lived on an Indian mound on the Chatham River and was forced out by Ed Watson. Bill House started working for Chevalier plume hunting and collecting bird eggs. And then he reported that Ed Watson shot Maybelle Starr on her birthday in February 1889. So this is a profile of what it was like living in the 10,000 Islands in the 1800s. And there were lots of mosquitoes. There was lots of plume hunting going on. And Ed Watson was a kind of an outlaw. And most of the people who lived in the 10,000 Islands during that period were outlaws who were hiding out from bad deeds that they'd done in the U.S. as a whole. And so everybody had secrets and were trying to avoid the law. And Ed Watson showed up and got to know everybody in the community, and he had resources, and he would go down to Key West and on his boat, and he would get in trouble there, and then eventually the residents of Chokoloskee, including Ted Smallwood's store, would decide that he was evil and he needed to be killed. And so this is a profile of the 10,000 Islands in the 1800s, and it's really, really informative.
So you'd call that historical fiction?
Yeah.
Like, it's probably fiction, but it's probably more accurate than other stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So my last book is called Men of the Mississippi, and this was written in 1951. And it's a classic. It's 20 chapters. This is the thinnest of the books we're talking about today, but it's also the largest. It's large format, 8.5 by 11 book. And it is profusely illustrated by the author. You can open one 2-page spread and there could be 6 different illustrations. And one of them might be a full page color illustration. And what the author says is this is a book about a river and a turtle in it. And he's basically used this plot device of having the small snapping turtle hatch out in the headwaters, I guess Lake Itasca, of the Mississippi River. And in the course of the 20 chapters, this turtle travels all the way down to the mouth of the Mississippi. And so because of what we've been going through lately, I thought I'd read some from chapter 17, which is about a flood. Men met two kinds of floods on this river, the fast kind and a slow. A slow flood aroused her from her winter sleep a mile up a side stream. Swollen Mississippi waters backed up the stream from its mouth, crept across fields, reached the levee again on its landward side. Thus a slow, silent flood lay alongside a raging river, dry levee top between, a pitiful ribbon of land threading a desert of waters. At first, sleepy men was pushed by the slow flood. She bumped through woods where raccoons, possums, terrified bobcats clutched at trees. Cows, knee-deep in water, could find no dry standing place. Men rolled down a road where cars sputtered and died, their drivers wading away. A two-floor, an attic house far back from the crowded levee, she hid behind iron kettles on a flooded porch. Rowboats came bringing dogs, old folks, children, women, men. These John boats also brought bedding, boxes, pots, pans, banjos, guitars. That night, the candlelit house was gay with plunked-up courage. Next day, scows brought chickens, pigs, calves, a baby mule. Men in the flood had now moved well inside, surfacing near a row of monstrous white teeth. Men left that piano to dive under a stove. Boys swam gleefully toward stairs. Little girls stared from John boats coming through windows. A baby splashed under in a stream of bubbles, but scrawny arms snatched him up before he sank to the floor. Next day, Mim bumped the ceiling. She fought through festoons of sagging wallpapers and padded out to the porch roof. The house was noisy, but not with music. From an upper window flowed an unglued guitar. Min followed lazily. She returned to find only a tent-shaped roof above water. A man at the attic window shot swimming snakes, but other snakes crawled unseen upon the roof. An oar burst upward through shingles, waving a diaper. A big boat turned towards treetops toward it, and joining itself to the attic window with planks. Min left the glad noises to go below, where even the snarling piano now sat smothered with silt. When she surfaced again, the rescued people were gone. Two sopping, exhausted panthers slept on the bed by an attic window. Beside them, contentedly rat-filled, four cottonmouth snakes lie coiled. It was a slow flood. So this is just a great book. It's I think, considered a children's book. It's great to read over a period of evenings. There are illustrations not only of wildlife and the landscape, but maps of different sections of the river. And he wrote a number of other books. Paddle to the Sea, which is a story of a carved canoe that goes through the Great Lakes. So before I turn it back, do you have another book, Jewel?
No.
Okay, well, let me do this. The Community Harvest SRQ will host Local Regeneration Study Series, a book club type event where attendees will read one book a month in July, August, and September. The book for July is The Transition Handbook by Rob Hopkins. This is a guidebook to thinking globally and acting locally. Books are available at the Community Harvest SRQ Sarasota office. The July Study Series discussion group will take place on July 31st at 6:30 p.m. at the Resilience Incubator. And we need to get more guests from the Resilience Incubator. That's at 1760 Mound Street in Sarasota. More information is available by visiting communityharvestsrq.org.
So let's talk further about the six books that we have chosen for this half hour. And so Beak of the Finch is a very elaborate exploration of the age-old ideas that of natural selection that Charles Darwin first wrote about in The Origin of Species. And then it mixes together that with more current examples of evolution, and it really convinces you that evolution is really happening. And so it happens not slowly but rapidly in response to natural selection pressures.
So I'd like to read a little more. There's from Min, and this is a section that deals with from 1811, and so supposedly Min made this voyage in the 1800s, and in 1811 it was the New Madrid earthquake, and so Min experiences the earthquake. Steamboats changed the rivers, planted new towns and people. Like keelboats, they had their days of glory. Then came steam cars, now other cars, rolling on rubber, coaxed steamboat towns to new highways back from the waterfront, while all steel towboats with screws and no paddle wheels pushed barges instead of towing. Seems like the world's been crazy since 1811, when that first steamboat hit the river. Yep, old Mississippi sure went crazy that year. New Madrid earthquake, worst in U.S. history, rocked the frontier. Lightning flashes, choking sulfur fumes, thundering roars, folks screaming, fowls screeching, cattle bawling, seemed like the end of the world. There were cabins crumbling, folks dying, earth cracks gaping and swallowing things. Tree rows leaned back, whipped over, crashed down, and the billows rolled through the forest. across solid fields like waves on a liquid sea. And the river, it sucked itself dry from banks to bed, pulling itself apart. It slammed tons of barges on bare riverbed at New Madrid, and the crews ran ashore on sand bottom. Some made it, but the river came back 12 feet tall to scoop up wrecks, scoop the wrecks under and race uphill for a whole minute. New Madrid sank some 15 feet. The earth shuddered off and on a couple of years. Even cows got used to staggering. The crazy river had made Big Real Foot Lake south of Hickman, where no lake was before. That steamboat slid down to New Orleans in safety. Old engines said its bad magic made the quake. However, steamboats did change the river. Men swimming along her sunken staterooms like a serving platter carried by unseen hands did not know that the long-ago earthquake had heaped her sandpile.
So we visited New Madrid.
And Real Foot Lake.
And Real Foot Lake. Yeah. And when we were going to the eclipse last spring, last April.
Right.
The National Wildlife Refuge there did not have a copy of Men of the Mississippi.
That was outrageous.
It was outrageous, right?
Yeah.
So my next book is The Swamp, and this one describes all the politics and all of the initiatives to remove Seminoles from it's like a political history of all the attempts to drain the Everglades that mostly failed, and how all of that starting in the 1800s and continuing up until 2005 when the Corps of Engineers decided that they were going to try to get money from the federal government to restore the damage that they had done previously. And that was the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. And so that was the SERP. And so, that's a pretty interesting, political history. Back to you, Jono.
Yeah. So the last chapter in Reading the Landscape of America is not about some natural history area. I mean, there's a lot of natural history, but it's a suburban story. It's called The Stylish House or Fashions as an Ecological Factor, and it follows a single house through six generations and how the landscaping changed. And I'll just read a couple of paragraphs, and then we probably need to close out. In her flower garden, Kay did not favor white flowers as much as Nancy Ann had, nor did she lean to the pastel shades that Elizabeth had. She planned her garden with a color chart and chose analogous colors rather than the complementary colors so long in favor. She liked the combinations such as deep purple and clear blue. When she picked flowers to bring the house, she struck poses that fascinated Don. She would rear up, tilt her head back, squint her eyes, and sketch Hogarth's curve of beauty in air with her clippers. Then she would ignore the lush, fulsome flower cluster that would have delighted patients and chose a tortured, asymmetrical spray. From this, she proceeded to remove any leaves that interfered with the gesture or movement or flow of line or mood. Sometimes all of them interfered. So it's just a really detailed accounting of how fashions have changed.
You've been listening to Our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court. You can also hear our show on WBPV LP Radio 100.1 Bradenton or listen online.
Today's show number 66 featured Charles Hines, the Trust for Public Lands Florida Gulf Coast Trails Coordinator, as well as some reviews of books that Julie and I think highly of.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Previous shows of Our Changing Environment may be accessed on the WSLR archives. Go to archive.wslr.org.
If you'd like to be notified about upcoming shows, you can join the Facebook group, Our Changing Environment. This is a great place to hear recent shows. Tune in next week at 9 a.m. for the Healthy Living Hour with Rebecca Acosta.
And tune in at 9 a.m. 2 weeks from today on August 5th for the next episode of Our Changing Environment.
If you're interested in local public affairs, tune in every Thursday at 9 for The Detail, hosted by Kathy Antunes.
Lost my place here. And don't forget to check out the live music. Local affairs. I'm sorry. Don't forget to check out.